The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Dr. Scott Youngkin for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues. For the next half hour, I'm going to be reading articles from the Harvard Heart Letter and then from the Mayo Clinic Health Letter. And the first article I'm going to read from the Harvard Heart Letter of September 2022 is entitled "The Heart Disease Gender Gap. Social and cultural factors may help explain why women don't fare as well as men when it comes to treating coronary artery disease." For at least three decades, heart disease has been the number one cause of death for both women and men in America. So why are heart problems still often unrecognized and undertreated among women? Sex-specific differences grounded in biology may play a role. The overall prevalence of coronary artery disease is lower in women, and they tend to develop heart problems at older ages. The average age of first heart attack in men is 65, compared with 72 in women. But gender, which refers to the social and cultural characteristics associated with being male or female, has contributed to disparities in cardiovascular care, according to an editorial in the April 12, 2022 issue of the Journal of the American College of Cardiology. There are gender-based gaps at every possible level, from women's awareness of symptoms to how they're treated in the emergency room and doctor's office, says cardiologist Dr. Michelle O'Donohue, associate professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School. While many factors are at play, one major underlying issue is that historically women simply haven't been well represented in clinical trials of heart-related conditions. But the culture is slowly changing, and some of the gaps are starting to close, she adds. Starting in the early 2000s, campaigns to boost awareness of heart disease in women made some headway. In less than a decade, the percentage of women who recognized heart disease as the leading killer of women nearly doubled. More recent data has been discouraging, however. A 2019 survey by the American Heart Association found that only 44% of women correctly identified heart disease as the most lethal health threat, compared with 65% in 2009. During a heart attack, chest discomfort, often described as pressure, tightness, or a squeezing sensation, is by far the most common symptom for both men and women. Women are slightly more likely than men to also report other symptoms like nausea, fatigue, and breathlessness. And while these symptoms have long been called atypical, a better term may be understudied, according to some cardiologists. In addition, three uncommon and poorly understood types of heart attacks are far more prevalent in women. The article goes on to talk more about these unusual types of heart attacks. Most heart attacks happen when a blood clot obstructs a narrowed artery supplying the heart, but there are several less common scenarios which can disrupt coronary blood flow, causing similar symptoms. The first is myocardial ischemia with non-obstructive arteries, or MINOCA. In other words, damage to the heart that occurs even though there isn't a blood clot in an artery. This refers to heart attacks in which the coronary arteries do not have significant narrowing. There are several potential causes. These include temporary tightening of the heart's arteries or coronary spasm, or blockage in very tiny arteries. MINOCA is five times more common in women than men. The next thing that can happen sometimes is spontaneous coronary artery dissection, which results from a tear in the inner wall of one of the heart's arteries, which creates a flap or swelling. About 90% of people with SCAD, or spontaneous coronary artery dissection, are women. And the third thing is stress cardiomyopathy. This is also called broken heart syndrome and typically occurs after severe emotional or physical stress, triggering a surge of hormones that alters the heart's shape. 80% of the cases are in women, but the outcomes are worse in men. Going on with the article, research suggests that women tend to downplay their symptoms and delay seeking treatment, but healthcare providers may be contributing to this problem. One 2022 study found that women who came to the emergency room with chest pain had to wait an average of 11 minutes longer to see a doctor or nurse than men who described similar problems. The findings, gleaned from data on millions of emergency department visits, also found that women were less likely to receive an electrocardiogram and less likely to be hospitalized. Earlier studies have shown that women are also less likely to be referred for diagnostic tests to check for coronary artery disease, the underlying cause of most heart attacks. They're also less likely to be referred to a specialist. Women who receive treatment, either medication or surgical procedures, for this common condition tend to have worse outcomes than men do. All of these trends underscore the need for additional research that includes more women, says Dr. O'Donohue. In a 2020 review of cardiovascular trials from 2010 to 2017, women made up only about 27% of participants in studies of coronary artery disease, although that figure is improving. Finally, from the Harvard Heart Letter of September 2022, I'm going to read an article entitled "The Lowdown on Good Cholesterol." Long touted as beneficial for heart health, high-density lipoprotein, or HDL, is more complicated than once thought. Our bodies rely on cholesterol to create cell membranes, make hormones, and synthesize vitamin D, among other things. This waxy fat travels through the body in tiny particles called lipoproteins, which come in a range of shapes and sizes. But too much of the wrong type in the wrong place can create problems. The tale of bad low-density lipoprotein is pretty straightforward. Excess LDL, or low-density lipoprotein, ends up in the artery walls, triggering plaque buildup and inflammation, and raising heart attack risk. Lowering LDL reduces that risk, but the story of good high-density lipoprotein, or HDL, is a bit more complex. We used to think of HDL as protective because it grabs cholesterol from the bloodstream and other tissues and transports it to the liver, where it's recycled or disposed, says Dr. Jorge Plutsky, Director of Preventive Cardiology at Harvard-affiliated Brigham and Women's Hospital. But it turns out that not all HDL particles perform this function, which is known as reverse cholesterol transport. In other words, not all HDL particles grab cholesterol from the bloodstream. Some types of HDL are indifferent to cholesterol, and others actually block the process of reverse cholesterol transport. Over the past decade, five different experimental drugs known as CETP inhibitors have been tested in large clinical trials in people with low HDL. All the drugs raise HDL dramatically, but most haven't clearly achieved their real goal, preventing heart attack, stroke, and other complications from clogged arteries. Maybe that's because they increased the wrong type of HDL. According to researchers at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health, who scrutinized 16 of the 200-plus different subtypes of HDL. In a study published in 2021 in Arteriosclerosis, Thrombosis, and Vascular Biology, they found that two of the experimental drugs, evacetrapib and torcetrapib, tended to raise the subtypes of HDL that are not associated with cardiovascular benefit. Another new CETP inhibitor called obicetrapib looks promising. When taken with a high-intensity statin, the drug raises HDL, but also lowers LDL by 50%. Larger studies of this experimental drug are currently underway. Past observational studies in a large group of people have suggested that those with a higher HDL, above 40 for men and 50 for women, tend to have fewer heart attacks. But a recent analysis found that people with very high HDL, 80 or higher, were about as likely to die from heart disease as people with low HDL, 30 or lower. The findings, gleaned from 20,000 people with heart disease, were published in the May 18, 2022 issue of JAMA Cardiology. Rare genetic variations known to cause high HDL, but also increased heart disease risk, didn't explain these paradoxical findings. Other health habits could be at play, like frequent alcohol intake, which is known to raise HDL and may increase heart attack risk. In addition, a national large health survey found that people who consumed 10% of total calories from added sugar were up to 3 times more likely to have low HDL as those who took half that much sugar. People who consumed the most sugar had HDL levels that were about 11 points lower than the low sugar intake group. Other research has linked high sugar diets with an increased risk of death from heart disease. What should you make of these new results? A very low or very high HDL should be a red flag warning to double down on your efforts to dodge heart disease. Traditionally, the things that doctors recommended to keep your heart healthy, like exercising and eating a mostly plant-based diet, are also thought to boost HDL. That's especially true for people who have high triglycerides, which tend to go hand in hand with low HDL, says Dr. Plutsky. Also, lifestyle changes have clear benefits, even if they don't change your HDL levels. For example, among people who smoke, quitting can cause increase in the HDL level and is also known to markedly reduce cardiovascular risk. For lowering your risk of heart attack and stroke, reducing elevated LDL cholesterol is still the main priority, says Dr. Plutsky. If you already had a heart attack or have been diagnosed with heart disease, aim for an LDL of at least 70, if not lower. For everyone else, an LDL of 100 or lower is a good goal. Well, now we're going to go to the Mayo Clinic Health Letter, and this is the September 2022 issue, and we're going to talk about lymphomas. That's LYMPHOMAS. Perhaps you've known people with lymphoma but didn't quite understand all that the disease entailed. Likely you have heard of two major types of lymphoma, Hodgkin's lymphoma and non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. But unknown to many people, there aren't just two kinds of lymphomas. Rather, there are almost 100 different subtypes, and these categories help determine which treatment is best. It's really unfair to put all the diseases that are lymphomas in one category, says Dr. J.C. Villas-Boas, a Mayo Clinic hematologist with expertise in lymphoma. He says it is the same with the term cancer. It's hard to put everything under one umbrella. Lymphomas are cancers of the lymphatic system, an important component of the immune system that defends against germs and infection. Lymphomas can be found in the lymph nodes, the liver, the spleen, and the bone marrow. To help sift through the variety of lymphomas, Dr. Villas-Boas likes to use another categorization, aggressive versus slow growing. Another term for slow growing is indolent, I-N-D-O-L-E-N-T. Aggressive lymphomas find you when symptoms show up, Dr. Villas-Boas says. Slow-growing lymphomas may not have obvious symptoms and may only be found by accident. While aggressive lymphomas typically require prompt treatment, your healthcare provider may advise a watch-and-wait approach for slow-growing lymphomas. Dr. Villas-Boas goes on to answer common questions and offer key insights into lymphomas. And the next part of this article is the doctor answering some questions. Question: what are the symptoms of lymphoma? Answer: it depends on the type of lymphoma. For aggressive lymphomas, symptoms can include fevers that may be recurrent and night sweats. This is not a subtle type of sweat. I'm talking about drenching night sweats. When I'm treating someone, I always ask, have you ever had to change your sheets, pillowcase, or pajamas? These lymphomas can also cause unintentional weight loss. So you're not trying to diet or exercise, but you're losing pounds. Sweating and weight loss are called constitutional symptoms. But these symptoms are not unique to lymphomas, and many people with lymphoma have never had them. Because lymphomas can happen in virtually any part of the body, you can have more specific symptoms associated with the site of the lymphoma or growing mass. For example, a lymphoma in your abdomen or chest can lead to abdominal pain, shortness of breath, or chest pain. Slow-growing lymphomas typically don't come with many symptoms. If anything, there may be an enlarged lymph node. So someone goes to the emergency room with a kidney stone, gets a CT scan, and doctors find a tumor that may have been sitting there for years. Dr. Villas-Boas is asked, what causes lymphoma? Unlike some other cancers with a clear provoking factor, for example, the clear association between smoking and the development of lung cancer, there's not a strong link or cause of lymphoma. But there are very rare exceptions. For example, H. pylori infection in the stomach is strongly associated with a very specific type of lymphoma. There are themes, however. Aging increases the risk of developing lymphoma. People accumulate genetic errors in their DNA as time goes on. These errors can make people prone to the development of lymphomas. Another theme is immunity, which is tightly related to lymphoma. People with impaired or dysfunctional immune systems, for example, people that have autoimmune diseases or an organ transplant that requires immune-suppressing medication, are at increased risk of lymphoma. Agent Orange and some pesticides also seem to be associated with lymphoma. But those are only associations so far. They have not been proved to cause lymphoma. When do people typically develop lymphoma? Hodgkin lymphoma typically develops in two peaks. One is between age 15 and 35, and that's when you often hear about people with Hodgkin lymphoma, because that's quite a dramatic event in a young person's life. And then there's a second peak for Hodgkin's lymphoma later in life, after age 50. With non-Hodgkin lymphoma, the risk just keeps increasing the older you get. How is lymphoma diagnosed? One of the first steps is to get a blood count test to make sure there's nothing circulating in the blood that points to a different issue, like an infection. And then it's important to get an adequate tissue sample to make the diagnosis. I stress adequate because many times patients will come to me after having been through two or three needle biopsies in which a very small piece of tissue was taken or a small amount of liquid and cells was obtained from a tumor with a fine needle. That's not usually sufficient to diagnose lymphoma or accurately identify the subtype. An adequate amount of tissue is needed to look at the architecture of the tumor. Where are the cancer cells, and where are they in context with surrounding cells? The information is crucial for an accurate diagnosis. How is lymphoma treated? After diagnosis, we stage lymphoma. This involves trying to find out whether the lymphoma is localized to that one lymph node area or whether it can already be seen in other lymph nodes or tissues. Usually a scan is done, such as a PET scan and a computerized tomography, all done together. This is called a PET CT scan. In some cases, we also need to perform a bone marrow biopsy to find out whether lymphoma is in the bone marrow. Finally, we'll come up with a management plan for the lymphoma. With some indolent lymphomas, we may decide to just follow the lymphoma without treatment. We commonly use chemotherapy to treat aggressive lymphomas and certain indolent lymphomas. And sometimes we combine chemotherapy with additional tools like radiation and immunotherapy. Immunotherapy uses drugs that won't necessarily kill the lymphoma cells, but the drugs can use or modify the immune system to help get rid of the lymphoma. There are also targeted therapy drugs, which usually act on a specific gene, metabolic pathway, or part of the cell to treat the cancer. If a lymphoma is aggressive or doesn't get better after treatment, or if it returns after the initial treatment, specialized treatments may be needed, and one such option is stem cell transplantation. More recently, we're using a new treatment called CAR-T cell therapy, which stands for chimeric antigen receptor T cell therapy. This is a way to genetically modify a person's immune system to best fight the lymphoma. Is there anything that helps to prevent lymphoma? Immunity is important, so keeping your immune system as strong as possible, in theory, could help prevent lymphoma. A study done at the Mayo Clinic showed that people who were physically active before their diagnosis of lymphoma did better than those who were not active. The same was true for people who were active after a diagnosis. The chance of dying of lymphoma was decreased in those with higher activity. And although studies are still underway to explore this link, I have to believe it's mediated by the immune system. People who exercise have healthier immune systems. This might allow their body to keep the lymphoma under control and prevent the lymphoma from returning. How do you know if you're getting the best care for lymphoma? First of all, it's not as common as some other cancers. Every year in the United States, there are 250,000 cases of breast cancer, but only about 90,000 cases of lymphoma. Most cancer doctors will not see many people with lymphoma in any given month or year. And having so many different types inside one simple label of lymphoma means that it's a good idea to have your diagnosis verified by a medical center with a high volume of cases, with an expert who actually sees this type of disease day in and day out. It's important to seek care, or at least an opinion, from a medical center with a high volume of people with lymphoma. the Lymphoma Research Foundation helpline at 800-500-9976 or helpline at lymphoma.org can guide you to treatment centers, specialists, and clinical trials. Most lymphomas are curable. That's why it's important to make sure you have the accurate diagnosis and accurate staging, because that will give you the best chance of a positive outcome. Next to this article is a brief article about miscarriage. Someone you know just experienced an early pregnancy loss or miscarriage. Your first inclination may be to avoid addressing it for fear of saying the wrong thing. However, early pregnancy loss can be isolating at a time when a person needs love and support the most. There are ways you can help during this time. You should avoid cliches and platitudes. You might struggle to find the right words to comfort someone. Even well-intentioned expressions can cause distress. For example, trying to find a bright side of the loss by saying, "At least it was early," or "Everything happens for a reason." Words like that minimize pregnancy loss. Often a simple heartfelt phrase like, "Please know I'm here for you and love you," is enough. You should follow the family's lead. Everybody moves through the stages of grief at a different pace. Especially in the beginning, some parents may still be in shock and wish to grieve in private. Others may want to talk openly about their experience soon after the miscarriage. You should offer reassurance. When an early pregnancy loss occurs, self-blame is common. Also, you should lend your support. If a grieving family is open to it, offer to help keep up with day-to-day chores, like cooking meals, cleaning the house, or grocery shopping. You can show support in other ways, too, like sending flowers or a sympathy card. Well, it looks like we've run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen next time. I sure hope you enjoyed it. I'm Dr. Scott Youngkin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thanks for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Thank you.